And today, Helen is going to speak about whether our youth justice system is broken. Thank you, Helen.
Good afternoon. Well, I just sort of told Tori that I'm one of the good liberals, but I don't know, we'll see by the end of this presentation. All of that introduction is a little bit embarrassing because what it boils down to really is that I'm a bit of a scrappy criminal lawyer slash public servant policy person. And you might have seen this week that in spite of that public service background and a declared cynicism of the media, which I avoid significantly, I put myself into the media to talk about the role that the media is playing in relation to young people in the state of Victoria and the fact that it is actually harming young people in the community. This morning I was launching another conference where we were talking about therapeutic lawyering in the criminal justice system. And young lawyers from across the state in my program area at Victoria Legal Aid converged upon a lovely venue at the Flagstaff Gardens, and I had the privilege of being part of a welcome to country that Uncle Ron Jones did for us with a smoking ceremony. And I can actually still smell the cleansing eucalyptus from the smoking ceremony. And it's actually quite symbolic standing in this beautiful venue and the design elements that go into this venue and their connection to Indigenous culture. And I, in turn, say that I acknowledge the traditional owners of the land upon which we meet today and which we're conferencing in, and I pay my respect to elders past and present. And I say so with a heavy heart in the sense that we're not closing the gap. And not only are we not closing the gap, we're moving backwards, both in this state and across this country. And the single most urgent, in my view, criminal justice policy for federal and state justice departments is to address the disproportionate incarceration rates of Indigenous children moving into adulthood, between 13 and 15 times more likely than non-Indigenous people to be incarcerated, and the absolute overrepresentation of Indigenous children in our child protection systems. They stay in that system longer, and they're kept from their families longer in what is often a very paternalistic set of state government regimes. So we don't seem to have made much progress. And 30 years ago, it's probably more than 30 years ago, the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody made a number of recommendations, and yet, in the last 5 years, we still have deaths in custody of Indigenous people. So closing the gap is not really working, and I think we really need to recommit in a different way. I make those comments because I don't want the omission of me referencing Indigenous youth in my comments today to be in any way an indication that that's not an important justice priority. It's just that the topic that I'm going to talk to you about today, which I've kind of rhetorically kind of posed a pretty cheeky question, is the system broken, the youth justice system broken, doesn't necessarily touch on specific groups, but please be under no misapprehension that I do think that's one of our number one justice priorities. If you look at the media at the moment, triggered by the Moomba riots earlier this year, you'd be forgiven if you thought that we are in the grip of a youth crime epidemic. Members of the community, and I hesitate to raise this because I do not want to give it more airtime, but I think it's important to raise it briefly. Members of the community are anecdotally, apparently, according to the tabloid media, arming themselves with baseball bats in large segments of our suburbs because of fear, the fear of youth invading their homes. That is an incredibly distressing story to be in our media and to think that members of our community feel that kind of fear. And that is not to dismiss the fact that there will be members of the community who do feel that fear. It's not to to play it down in any way. But what a distressing state of affairs that we find ourselves in 2016 in this kind of environment. When you look at the story of the prevailing popular media narrative, it's really corrosive. It's about dangerous teenagers engaging in rioting behaviour, brazenly committing home invasions, carjackings, for the thrill of it. And if you look at the way they link some of the reporting and the language in the stories that are proliferating our social and press media, they're talking about African youths or Muslim youths or other youths from ethnically diverse communities linked to particular suburbs and locations. And that is a particularly dangerous link to be making with the language that's being used and the story that's being constructed. And it warrants really increased scrutiny, both in the courtroom and outside of it. And I say in and outside of the courtroom because there are lots of things we can do in the courtroom case by case, but there's far more important types of advocacy we need to engage in outside of the courtroom. But to give you, this is the scrappy criminal lawyer in me, one of the examples of the in-court advocacy that happened this very week, and that was the opposition of the tabloid press application to have CCTV footage of three young offenders committing some pretty serious armed robberies released to them so they could put those images in alongside their brazen thugs' stories. Now, there are very special provisions in the Children's Court jurisdiction and in our legislation, the Children, Youth and Families Act, that prohibit the identification and publication of materials that go to a child's identity in criminal proceedings. And they are very restrictive laws for a reason. The laws in relation to children and how we sentence children and how we deal with them when they do commit criminal offences are understandably, I think most members of the community would understand this, different to the way we treat adult offenders, and they must be different. Now, in this application, the words public interest were used to explain why, alongside the story being told about the offending, there also needed to be these particular images. And the notion of public interest is a very complex one, and it means different things in different contexts. And in this instance, I'm very pleased to say that the President of the Children's Court refused the application. Now, let me be clear. I'm not suggesting for one minute that the media doesn't have a critical, the independent media doesn't have a critical role to play in our society, that it's not important that they actually report accurately in a balanced way, that they actually provide the community with information in that way. I'm not saying that for one minute. But we must be very vigilant about challenging, as I say, narratives which are not based in evidence, which are not based in fact, and which have divisive, corrosive impacts that actually drive fear and potentially incite really harmful outcomes for young people in particular. So the data actually shows, so let's look at some of the facts. Data's a little bit complex, I'm not going to sort of descend into statistics, but I will tell you to look at two publications from this week which are really important. The Crime Statistic Agency, which is our newish independent statistics agency. New South Wales has BOCSAR, which many of you will be familiar with. We have the Crime Stats Agency. Go to their website and they've got some really helpful stats. And overall, youth crime is declining. Everyone agrees with that. Even the popular press agrees with that. The other publication I urge you to read is the Sentencing Advisory Council's report, also issued this week, which gives you fabulous information in terms of exactly what's going on. And information is power. So we've got a youth crime rate that's actually declining, And not just in Victoria, by the way, across the country and across other countries in the world, the United States, New Zealand, Canada. But we've got to be careful that we ourselves don't fall into the same trap that I'm accusing the media of falling into, quite deliberately, and that is that we also test our own stories. And that is, the reality is there is a very small group of offenders who are committing serious offences, and they're having a really significant impact on victims and the community. We can't ignore that. We can't ignore the impact of that. And it's uncomfortable, but there will be a small number of those offenders where, from a criminal law perspective, from a sentencing perspective, we will need to detain them. And we will need to use strict supervision. And that is uncomfortable. The detention of a child is uncomfortable. So we can't shy away from that reality either. But what's more important, and here's where we've got to shift the public debate, is, well, what do we do with those young kids? We're not just going to lock them up for a long time, because that doesn't work. The evidence is in. It's in from a lot of places around the world where mass incarceration has been used as a law and order policy. It just doesn't work. And it particularly is damaging for children and young people. In fact, what it does is it can entrench them in crime. So what we've got to shift the focus to, even with these young serious offenders, is, well, what do we do with them, both in the community but also in the custodial setting? And if we really examine what needs to be done, we will know that we have to intensively support that young person before we even get to the courtroom, let alone what we're doing with them when they're incarcerated, and of course when we release them back into the community. And those supports can't be what we currently have, which are poorly funded programs in a patchwork sort of quilt of services, where you've got postcode injustice happening in terms of where you live or where a child happens to be. We are talking about intensive support services that go to the causes of criminal offending. And those causes have nothing to do with what the papers are talking about. They are about economic inequality, unemployment, education. They are about victimisation. Children have a high rate of victimisation. They are about child protection issues, residential care issues, family violence. You can see that it's actually a whole range of socioeconomic issues that are creating, if you like, conditions where we have totally locked out young people committing serious offences. So if we're not actually addressing those things through our criminal justice system, but also outside of it, we are creating a revolving door, and we are entrenching young people, and in particular entrenching young people from suburban ethnic minority groups into lives of crime. That is the risk we face here. So when we have very corrosive media narratives like this, what they do is they militate against smart problem solving. They create pressure on politicians. And unfortunately, over the last 5 years, what I have seen is a lot of reactive, short-term criminal justice policy. It's very seductive to politicians to find the quick fix. And the more we have these concerted campaigns, not based on fact and evidence and balance, the more we go towards law and order policies that are proven not to work. So some examples: we change our bail laws, we tighten them up. So the youth bail laws that were turned back earlier this year, and hopefully will undo a very sharp increase in the remand of unsentenced children. You can see how laws can actually operate in a way to entrench disadvantage. They can actually operate to create racial discrimination through the very processes of justice that are meant to be blind. So we've got these youth bail laws, for example. We've got stricter sentencing laws. We're building more prisons. We're doing a range of things that have a very short-term focus and will result in disproportionate rates of incarceration when you actually look at things like your population demographics and you look at actual crime rates, which are also dropping, by the way. There are some areas where they're increasing, a lot around certain types of property and, of course, drug offences. And what sort of drug offences are we talking about? We're not talking about, you know, the stuff of, you know, the big fish, a commercial quantity traffickers. We're talking drug possession and drug use. So we're criminalising what is essentially an addiction or health issue. So reactive justice policy like that certainly doesn't serve the adult system, but I was kind of hoping that it would never infect the children's court jurisdiction. And then Moomba riots happened, and now we're in the throes of a really risky situation where it is through the cumulative chipping away erosion of fundamental rights and things we take for granted in the children's court system. That's the risk and the fear I have, that over time, it'll be sort of by a thousand cuts that we get to a really punitive children's court jurisdiction. And it must be protected. It is a special jurisdiction for a reason. It is a jurisdiction that gives primacy to the rehabilitation of the young person. It is a jurisdiction which says it's about connecting that young person back to their family and back to everything that will get them back on track to enjoy community life again. So there's a lot of improvements in the youth justice system, and I use that phrase quite broadly to capture lots of different components. It is quite a labyrinth of services and programs, and there's a whole lot of complexity in the children's court system. But overall, when you look at the sentencing processes, the laws, some of the programs that are currently available, the approach that the children's court takes, which is very much linked into international human rights instruments, you can actually see it throughout the whole Children, Youth and Families Act. When you examine all of those things, clearly the answer to that rhetorical question is far from broken. The system is far from broken. Doesn't mean that it doesn't need significant improvement. At the Chief Commissioner's Police Youth Summit yesterday, we heard directly from young people. And people who work as youth workers in corrections, who are on that sort of front line working with young people, the stories aren't surprising to them. They're living these stories every day, just as legal aid lawyers are living them every day with our young clients. These young people talked about being hopeless, of no employment prospects. They talked about stark experiences of racism. It wasn't just the case that racism was blocking. So one young man said, just my name, I know, is stopping me from even getting my resume past the gate. It was about the breaking down of their identity and resilience day in, day out. It was really confronting. We like to think sometimes, we bury our head in the sand, that, you know, that kind of racism sort of happens elsewhere. But these young people were talking about racism and intolerance colouring everything they do every day of the week, and that was breaking them down. That was the phrase they used. It was locking them out. The media and this relentless 24/7 cycle, the social media, the debate that's happening nationally, politically, and across the world, and the increasing instability across the world, is impacting these young people. And coupled with local issues around the loss of opportunity, inequality that is structural, the lack of access to education, to justice, to basic things that we all take for granted. All of those things together are creating this locked out sense of despair. So that comes directly from young people who live alongside us. So when you really examine what we need to do to improve our youth justice system, and more broadly, what we need to do to improve our approach to young people across society, not just in the justice system, the answers all lie in those things they just told us. They are about the things that we take for granted: opportunity, prosperity, the so-called Australian fair go. It really boils down to belonging. And we were all adolescents. Many of us are parents. When we think about young people, there's a shared human experience around it. And that shared human experience doesn't need to take ethnicity, culture, or any of that into account, because it's about negotiating your identity. It's about impulsivity, a little bit of recklessness. It's what adolescence is defined by. It's about learning, negotiating who you are in the world, finding your place in the world. It's about negotiating consequences, empathy. It's about responsibility. What we know from our legal aid clients is that a lot of our child clients and young people that we represent, they're negotiating those things that we take for granted, which are part of growing up and adolescence. They are negotiating that in a very hostile, social, economic, individual, in terms of what's going on in their individual lives, and political context. Many of them have fractured families, many of them are struggling with addiction, many of them are in the child protection system, many of them are in residential care. So they are negotiating those things that we did with probably loving, supporting parents, families, friends. They are often negotiating that on their own. So when the papers talk about get tough on these marauding, rioting youths, and you just look at the sort of journey I tried to take us on in terms of what young people are telling us, what they're experiencing, and what we know from the children, the vulnerable children we represent in the legal system, that is just a silly, silly response to the issue of youth crime or antisocial behaviour. You cannot solve those things through the law. You just can't. So my plea following the youth summit was a good conversation, but it just sort of scratched the surface. My plea is that what we need to do first is come up with an overarching state youth strategy. And it's one that actually brings together lots of different government bureaucracies, lots of different legal services and legal solutions and the courts, alongside the social and welfare sector. It's got to bring them all together, and it's got to be an integrated system that we're working towards. It's got to be a system that has a vision, and the vision has to be linked to certain outcomes, and those outcomes should be about maximising prosperity for every child. They have to be about reducing reoffending and stopping offending from commencing. At the moment, the system, although it's working, doesn't have that overarching connectedness. And if we don't create the strategy, plan — I hate the word strategy, it's overused, let's call it a plan because that's what it is — if we don't have a plan with strong political leadership, we're kind of going to limp along, and we're going to leave a system and our young people at risk of the vagaries of politics, law and order, quick fixes, because the system isn't organised in that connected way. So my favourite piece of legislation, it's a bit nerdy, but you know, I told you I was a criminal lawyer and a public servant. It's a state piece of legislation. Hold your surprise, it is the Legal Aid Act. It was birthed in the 70s, the decade of my birth, by the great reformers of that decade. And it's a really inspiring piece of legislation, and legislation is not on the whole designed to be inspiring, let me tell you that, applying it daily in my work. But what's inspiring about this act and why I love it so much is that it talks about legal aid, delivering legal aid services in a way that's equitable, in a way that increases access to justice and legal remedies, in a way that's innovative, in that it reduces the need for individualised legal services across the community. It's a really powerful, powerful purpose. And then importantly, this is my favourite bit, it says we should do those things as the independent statutory agency in a way that dispels fear and distrust. Now, with that kind of great, inspiring statutory purpose comes great responsibility and great opportunity. I don't feel at the moment that I'm necessarily doing as much as I can to really deliver on that statutory objective. But my commitment every day is to keep doing better. And what I ask on behalf of myself and Victoria Legal Aid is that although the statutory duty is mine and it's the institution for which I work for, I ask you all to support me in executing that duty diligently on behalf of the community, for the community, even if it sometimes doesn't realise why it's important. But most importantly, I ask you to support me to execute that duty for the youngest and most vulnerable members of our community. Thank you.
Thank you, Helen, for that really topical and very timely talk. Thank you so much. We've got some time for some questions from the audience. And again, I'd remind you that we have our interns with their microphones, so do make sure you speak to the microphone. We have someone from the start. I'll be getting just before any questions. I can't talk about any of the Moomba Ryan cases. I can't talk about any cases in the media.
Hi, thank you for a fantastic talk. Skilled welfare services with the Department of Health. I really appreciate the fact that you touched on this media frenzy because it has been so detrimental to everything that we work towards in the department. But in light of that, the advantage here, I guess, is we have a patchwork service, and the focus here has kind of allowed us to sort of reevaluate our methodology that we sort of take in child protection and in new justice precinct. So with that in mind, my question is, have you received enough policy momentum here to affect actual change? Because it sounds like there's sort of a big discourse happening, and with what you said yesterday about attending sort of an evaluation of the police, chief of police, is that
right? So yesterday was a new summit with Victoria Police, supported by the Herald Sun. No, don't despair. I was a bit despairing. It was actually 250 academics, researchers, experts, people in the sector, as well as young people, police included, talking about youth crime, youth justice, youth welfare issues. And there was a remarkable amount of unanimity in the room. And there was a remarkable, I mean, the sector has been talking about some of these issues for a very, very long time. I kind of just touched them like a frog on lily pads, you know. So these aren't new issues, and I always like to look for the silver lining and not be overly cynical, although I do have a tendency towards it. And what I see yesterday doing is it's the commencement of a conversation, and it at least has started to shift some of the public narrative a little bit. But more importantly, it's created the platform for us to do some good policy thinking. I'm a little bit worried about the lens through which that policy thinking may happen. It is still through the police, and it is still through the public order committee process. And I'm a bit troubled by that, but I'm also hopeful that we're going to bring everyone we need to bring into the room to think more carefully about an integrated youth justice system.
Thank you.
I think there's a lot of work to happen though. It won't happen overnight. It's going to happen over years. So.
Another question.
You talked a lot about the causes of youth crime and issues that have a lot of it to do with, you mentioned, disadvantage, education, domestic violence. So I'm not sure the right person answers, but a holistic approach would be to not only approach at the end where the children are coming into the system, but the issues that are occurring at home and in their family lives. So what's the discussion around resolving those issues? For instance, we have the domestic violence or family violence issues here, and that's obviously causing enormous disruption, and obviously it could take a long time, but I'm assuming, what's the talk around that rather than the other end of the justice system?
Well, I think there's a lot, in fact that's probably the focus, particularly post-Royal Commission to Family Violence, which is really the blueprint for a whole systems approach, and which talks about the sort of front-ending, the jargon. That debate is sort of the focus, if you like, at the moment in the legal assistance sector. And absolutely, the court event has to become more effective at not just being an end of process, consequence-based event, but one where you're building therapeutic processes, early intervention processes, restorative justice processes, and not just at the court event, but we need to actually catch kids really early. Now, we're talking catch them when they're transitioning. If you listen to the academics around adolescent health, you need to catch them even before they get to high school. Now, the way to do that is in your sort of your universal education system, which unfortunately is not as strong as it used to be when many of us were probably going through school. You need to figure out how you identify the kids who are vulnerable at that really early stage. And that's why I say an integrated system is important, because you actually want to intervene well before you get to the courtroom. So it is the absolute focus in the sector. Victoria Legal Aid actually has a strategic direction which says we will prioritise early and timely intervention, because those two things mean different things, for young people and children. We'll try and do it through all of our service settings, but certainly we're prioritising children. Now, the Children's Court's actually pretty good at some of this type of work. It's a specialist court. So it already has diversion processes. One of the great announcements from this government was finally a statewide legislative youth diversion scheme. Paradoxically, we've had an adult diversion scheme for years, but not children's ones, so it's been really ad hoc. So the Children's Court already does that, but there is room for us to do more of it. We can expand youth conferencing. There's a whole lot of great ideas from New Zealand and across the world about how to build those early intervention points into the court system. But I think it's also important that we not just focus on the justice intervention. We can get that really perfect in terms of early intervention, but we've also got to get it right outside of the courtroom, because what I would like to see is less kids in court.
Yeah, we're cycling back around because they come out of that system again, and then they're back into a family that's still dysfunctional. function of organisations.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Sorry, I've got a long answer. Thank you. We've probably got time for one more question. There's another question. Yes.
You talked about engaging youth. How do you think you go about engaging the generation that we're currently seeing leading our country, trying to scale back money for university and education, then being the generation themselves where they got it for free? How do you ask them to commit to seeing that that's actually an important investment for a generation that doesn't necessarily have a voice yet?
I think it's a complex question and probably a complex answer, but let me put it as, I think what we need to do is appeal to the argument that works to the bad liberals, which may be a thing for us. I don't mean in terms of the bigger Liberal Party, but the bad liberals on both sides of Parliament. And what I mean by that is we've got to make an economic argument. There is some really good work happening across the justice sectors, but across government areas, where policy makers are talking about, you know, for example, for every dollar we spend in the child protection system or in residential care, that has a particular cost that flows on to the taxpayer. For every dollar we spend on prisons, for every dollar we spend on all interventions in the criminal justice system, there's a cost attached to it. So I think the economic argument is the one that will win the day, unfortunately. It's a little bit soulless, but it's quite powerful. And what's happening in America is, in Texas and Kansas, for example, you wouldn't expect this, but they've actually closed some prisons. And they've done that by appealing to conservative economic sort of solutions, saying, if you actually focus on re-offending and justice reinvestment, whilst we don't agree with the lead part progressives about what they're trying to do, it actually could be making sense in terms of the money we might be able to save, and then we can use the money elsewhere. So I think it's the economic argument that's going to carry a lot of sway, and the fact that at legal aid, for example, we know high frequency or high contact legal aid users are 3 times more likely to have come to us as a child protection or ResiCare kid, and to have experienced family violence before the age of 18. And we know, we can track through our client data, that those kids are going to turn into adult offenders. That is costing the taxpayer a lot of money. Now, I don't like just reducing things to economic units, but I do think there's a lot of power in that, and it will influence conservative policymakers. Thank you. Thank you very much. I think we're going to wind up that, but I